Deaf footballer Phil Camps has had quite the career. He's competed for Great Britain at the World Cup, the Deaf Olympics, and he is also a British Deaf Football Cup, an English Deaf Football Cup, and an English Deaf Football League winner. That's a lot of success to enjoy, particularly turning out for his country, which is a dream he had held ever since he was a little boy. But the journey is never that easy, and there's often some big bumps along the road. For Phil, one standout moment that proved just that was being one of the final players cut from the GB squad for the European Championships. It was a gut-wrenching thing to find out after working so hard in a training camp, only to be told he hadn't made it. But that setback arguably fueled the comeback, as he went on to work even harder, desperate to get what he wanted and play for his country, something he managed in the end. Following that success, however, came an abrupt end, when injury forced Phil to retire at the age of just 24. 3 years on, he keeps himself incredibly busy now, but he admits he is still looking for something that fills the void where football used to be. Phil, a warm welcome to the podcast. A pleasure to have you on, of course. How is everything, considering the weird way of the world and everyone's lives are still a little bit mixed up right now?
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure to come along and speak with you, Alistair. But yeah, no, things are going well. I think, you know, as well as we can expect during kind of lockdown number, at least on 3 or 4 at the moment. But yeah, no, you know, keeping very well.
Yeah, we're all starting to lose count a little bit of lockdowns, days, months, who knows. How are you coping with everything anyway? Because I suppose it's sort of the topical question that we ask all of our guests at the moment is, how are you finding it considering what life was like before?
Yeah, it's been a challenge. I think it's been a challenge for everyone to try and adapt to life post-COVID, although we're not post-COVID yet, we're still going through it, but compared to before the pandemic started to spread, it's been a challenge to adapt. I think I'm doing quite well. I think keeping myself busy and trying to be very intentional about reaching out and making connections with people, still being able to have conversations and video calls, and they're not the same as meeting people socially, but they go some way in helping kind of bridge that gap. But yeah, it has been a challenge, certainly ready for the warmer weather to roll in. A lot of snow this week, which has been nice, but when you can't go out and meet up with a bunch of people to have a nice snowball fight or something, it becomes a little less fun. So I think, yeah, just about ready for that warm weather to roll around, the vaccine to roll out a bit further and for things to start opening up again. But it's one of those tricky things. You understand why it's got to be done. And certainly, I think for me, I've been very fortunate that, you know, immediate family haven't been badly affected by the virus. So I feel very blessed in that sense. But yeah, just hoping that us as the world can move past this and get ourselves to a place where it's safe again to start doing things together.
I think that mirrors a lot of people's views right now, doesn't it? It seems so close, yet still quite far away to getting back to something that we had before. Got plenty of things to talk about, of course, as we often do on these episodes. Your career, life growing up, football, obviously. But before we begin, can I just check that your greatest sporting highlight is winning the Question of Mintridge competition in 2019 with me?
Yeah, well, I mean, 2019 was one of the times I won it. So yeah, certainly one of the highlights.
One of.
Yeah, no, we won again this year, which was good fun in 2020. And then 2018, I wasn't there to win that one, but won in 2017. So yeah, no, always certainly a career highlight.
No, I think I was third this year, which is disappointing.
You're on the wrong team.
But though, it's fine. taking you back then, essentially to I suppose, the beginning, and this is aimed primarily at people who are learning your story for the first time. How do you look back on your time growing up, particularly in school? Because I mean, you were educated in a school just like any other school, really, weren't you?
Yeah. So, yeah, growing up, so I'm deaf. So I played football, deaf football. My ears don't work quite as well as perhaps most of the population. And so I wear two hearing aids. And I got my first pair shortly before going into primary school for the first time. And hearing aids are quite good now compared to where they were kind of 23 years ago when I got my first pair. And they did allow me to hear a little bit of extra sound that I wouldn't have got otherwise. But I've still really, really struggled going into school trying to understand what teachers and classmates were saying. So yeah, certainly starting out and trying to get through education was a real challenge. I was the only ever deaf student at primary school and both secondary schools that I went to. And I think in a way that made things a bit more challenging. There was a real, I think, lack of understanding perhaps from classmates and other students around, you know, what that meant, what that meant for me in terms of my deafness. But I think with any challenge and with any adversity becomes the opportunity to overcome that, right? And building of resilience and other character traits that help you to deal with that. So yeah, certainly difficult early on, as you're kind of trying to grow and develop into a person. You talk about going to primary school, you're only 4 or 5 years old, you're not really who you're going to be yet. You figure that all out along the way. But looking back, I have very, very fond memories of school, but I do remember how challenging it was at the time.
Yeah, I've picked up a couple of things there. That one of them I didn't even consider is how much hearing aids have probably developed in that time. Is there a way to kind of quantifiably describe how much better they are than when you first got them 20 or so years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I can try. So when I first got my first pair of hearing aids, they were what we call analog hearing aids, which I guess you can probably compare to like analog televisions in that, you know, the manual has to be adjusted to, you know, pick up kind of an adapted slightly different sounds. And the way the analog digital aids were very, very simple. If you imagine you've got a microphone. So when you go to a rock concert, the singer's got a microphone and all the sound's blasted out through an amplifier or multiple amplifiers. It's a big concert. Hearing aids work the same way. There's a microphone on top of the hearing aid which picks up the sound and amplifies the sound into your ear at much higher volume. The digital hearing aids do a lot of stuff in between in terms of trying to eliminate what they think background sound and allow voices to come through and things like that, and have different settings that you can tweak into. So they've certainly improved. They're not perfect. There's still things that I'll obviously miss out on hearing. I still rely a lot on lip reading to understand most of my conversations that I have. But yeah, it's certainly improved a long way. But yeah, in terms of trying to describe what that change has been, it's been really, really difficult. I do remember upgrading from analog to digital hearing aids. And I used to think I could whistle quite well. As in, you know, whistling to a tune. I can't do it on the podcast because it's quite horrendous. But I only realised how horrendous it was after I got my digital hearing aids. And my parents and my brother and sister have been putting up with it for a number of years. Me thinking they had this wonderfully, you know, melody and lovely whistling tune. It was, not quite the case.
I think if we're starting whistling on the podcast, that comes with a headphone warning for anyone tuning in.
I avoid that.
Definitely. The lip reading side of things as well, because I think I read another interview with you where you had talked about sort of it being a little bit like tennis in school, where you're watching like the teacher talking to another student and it's kind of going back and forth, and it's quite tough to follow that. Is one of the challenges that comes with lip reading?
Yeah, certainly. So lip reading on a one-to-one basis is a lot easier than lip reading a group conversation, because you naturally know who the next person is going to be speaking. So I can just look at you and I can read your lips and I know when I stop talking, you're right to start. But when you have a group conversation, you pose a question, you've no idea who's jumping in next. So you often miss the first few words of what's said and you try to pick those up. But equally, people are jumping in at different times. You don't always wait for the person to finish. And so, yeah, your head starts going back and forth and you try and watch it. But I think in the classroom, it's particularly difficult because I used to try and sit myself right at the front. So I was as close to the teacher as I could. A for volume, B for, you know, being able to lip read. But that means everyone else is behind you. And so when the teacher asks a question, you're having to turn around and look behind you and then look back at the teacher. Yeah, it's not comfortable, but it's one of those things that you just learn to adapt to, I think.
And on that learning to adapt point, this is something we talked about with Olivia Breen when she was on this podcast, because she uses lip reading as well. And what with everyone having to wear face masks at the moment, and she was obviously a big advocate for having face masks that are see-through, so you can lip read. I don't know if that's something that you've had to consider or had to maybe adapt or tell people to take that into consideration at various points, considering face masks are very much part of our lives right now.
Yeah, no, and it has been a huge challenge for a lot of deaf people, a lot of people who rely on lip reading to communicate. And it's a really difficult barrier to cross, because I think the probably the best solution is these clear face masks. But what you get from that is that a lot of moisture stays within the mask, which isn't the most comfortable for the person wearing them. They're also very reflective, so any light often can bounce off, and even though they're clear, you still can't lip read with them. To be honest, the way around it for me, when I go shopping, and the only time I'm going out at the moment is to do food shopping, is I go through the self-checkout with the machines. So I'm scanning all my items into my trolley and then I'm scanning at the end and paying. I don't really have to deal with too much human interaction. But yeah, it is a real challenge, and I don't know the perfect solution or the way around it. But yeah, I mean, there have been things that have been designed, like cards that tell people you're a lip reader and you're deaf, that you can show to people and say, I rely on lip reading. Please can you lower your mask if you're behind a, you know, Perspex screen, or please can you write down the message or point and try and communicate in other ways. But yeah, I think there's a real balance to be found between staff feeling safe and deaf people being able to understand the communication.
Yeah, exactly. And increasing the awareness really about that could be a consideration when someone comes along. More of a difficult question. Back in those early days, did you often feel like the odd one out? And if you did, how did you cope with it?
Yeah, certainly. I think kids can be cruel. And any time people are different, they're often on the receiving end of that. So yeah, certainly growing up, felt the odd one out, was never surrounded by other people who were like me, as I say, like Jeff, and faced kind of that similar life experience until a bit later on in my teenage years. So yeah, certainly felt a little different. And I think that's where my passion and my love for football really grew from, was that was the one place where I didn't feel too different from anybody else. It was an escape from that abnormality, I guess, that difference to everyone else, in that when I was playing football, although communication often is a large part of that, on the playground and on the field at lunchtimes, it was just me and that ball and the other players. And it became a little refuge, a little escape for me from that. But certainly, yeah, growing up, and especially when you're young, anything that's small, that's different about you, get picked up on by everybody. I was certainly very conscious of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of brings us on perfectly to the sports side of things. And you've done quite a good job of describing it there, but I was going to ask, just can you define, or has it fully sunk in, how vital football, sport, is to you as a person in terms of making you who you are now?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the best way to define it is to try and look at my life without it. What would that have been? What would I be like? And it's very, very difficult to imagine. For me, sport was something I'm hugely passionate about now, but always was growing up. And it wasn't just football. Football was always number one for me. But I played everything growing up, from cricket to rugby to tennis to badminton. Like, PE was my favourite subject. Like, I did well in the classroom academically, but PE, just getting to go out and try different sports, and it was just so much fun. And to imagine a life without that, it's quite a sad picture for me. I think about all of the amazing people that I've met along the way, the things it's taught me and the traits that I've developed through my career in sport and the experiences I've had, the places I've been. It'd be very sad to imagine a life without that, but it's certainly a very important element of it. And even now that I've retired and I'm no longer playing, I watch so much American football, basketball, baseball, and quite excited about the Six Nations as well. Caught the England game last week, didn't quite go the way I was hoping, but just a huge fan of sport in general. It's a difficult one. It's a difficult one, but certainly a large part of my identity.
Yeah, you kind of strike on that. We always talk about it on this podcast because obviously we wouldn't do a podcast like this if we weren't sports fans as well. But there is just something about it that gives everyone so much more. That release you were talking about, that escapism you're talking about. And it is often hard to put that into words, just what it can bring and why it brings that. In terms of football, as you say, you talked on or tried out a lot of different sports. What is it about football? As in, is it the one that you just were best at, or what is it about it that really grabs you as opposed to some of the others maybe?
Yeah. Sure, I've never really thought about that. I think it was the first one, in a way, because at school, I mean, you couldn't play tennis at break time and lunchtime. Like, we weren't given a rugby ball and allowed to, throw each other around the field at lunchtime. Like, they were done in controlled settings, but football we were allowed to play, and we were given one on the playground. And like I said, that love for that sport was given to me very early on. When I was really struggling to understand what was going on at school, football became that escape when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And I think it just grew from there. I was able to practice it on my own in the back garden at home. Like, again, that's something just difficult to do with a sport like tennis, for example. I think it was a combination of access to the sport, the timing of which that I got into it. Certainly football is a tremendously popular sport. And I think it's down to so many different elements. Like, the team was a large part of it. Like, playing a team sport is a huge privilege and a huge benefit of that sport. Like, being able to work together with other people to try and achieve success collectively. And when you do, it's so much more rewarding than achieving something on your own. There's so many different elements of football that I love, but I think the reason it ended up becoming the number one for me is because it was the first one and the accessibility side of getting to play the sport.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of, I've kind of framed this as how big a moment was, but for you personally, signing for Charlton, were you 18 at the time, 19 at the time?
18, yeah.
And I think you've described it before as stepping into the deaf world for the first time. And considering what we'd talked about before with you feeling like the odd one out, is that almost the first time where you are one of everyone else and everyone's in it together?
Yeah, I guess to a sense, and my football teams growing up, although there weren't other deaf players, were still, still a great atmosphere, still felt part of the squad. But going and signing with Charlton was a really interesting experience, because in a way, finally you're surrounded by people just like you and you feel like one of everyone else. And in a way you don't, you're the outsider again, but in a slightly different way. So as a deaf person coming from the hearing world into the deaf world, there's still an element of trying to settle in there, but certainly I really embrace that change. And I've settled in immensely quickly and learning sign language at the time and being able to communicate with my teammates that way. And it's become probably, preferred method of communication is to use sign language. Like, it's such an expressive way of communicating. Certainly making that step into the deaf world, as some people call it, has been hugely beneficial and an element of my social life, but also my sporting career that was something I really cherish and love to be a part of even now.
Does that change you as a person as well? Make you grow as a person, I suppose?
Yeah, absolutely. I think being surrounded by people who have faced similar challenges to you is always a really humbling experience to know that, you know, you're not alone. Loads of other people have gone through this exact thing, and other people have dealt with it better than you, and other people have dealt with it worse. But a lot of people have gone through this challenge. It's not in and of itself all that unique. And I think having that information and being around people and see how other people cope with it and seeing how people view it in a way as a benefit and as a positive part of their identity, which is rightly it should be. I think you'll find this, and you probably have found this when speaking to other disabled sports people or disabled people. Very rarely do we view our disability as a disability or something negative. It's just another challenge perhaps we've tried to overcome, but a positive part of our identity that's allowed us to be involved as part of a slightly different culture than we would have been able to otherwise.
And almost a perfect example as well, because you can throw this out to probably anyone in any one position. Everyone's got their challenges and has faced their challenges. I suppose what you can pick up from being around them, learning from them, that you can apply to your own life at the same time. There's probably a lot to be gained for that.
This podcast is a member of The Bear, internet radio and podcast network. Find more great podcasts at thebear.live.
You're listening to Sportspiel, the Players Podcast. Focusing on your career specifically, because it's only right that we celebrate it after all. And there's a lot of highlights along the way, which I'll come to in a minute. But for those who may be thinking, how does deaf football work practically, gameplay, how the communication works, all that sort of stuff. Can you just kind of take us through, for anyone who might not have watched the game, just what it's actually like in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So deaf football is not that different from regular football, I guess. We just call it football. But yeah, certainly. The only change that occurs is that the referee carries a flag as well as a whistle. So when he blows his whistle, he waves his flag. Obviously, none of us are able to hear the whistle, but it's still blown for the purpose of fans who may be able to hear, the purpose of coaching staff who may be able to hear, and also, arguably, maybe more importantly, the other officials, if they're able to hear, can hear the whistle. So a whistle is blown, the flag is waved. But aside from that, rules are the same. We do have rules around hearing devices whilst competing. So in terms of playing deaf football, whether you're playing domestically or internationally, I believe this is still true, but when I was playing, the cutoff was a hearing loss of 55 decibels or more in your best ear. And so obviously with that, there's a huge spectrum. I mean, there's people of hearing losses of 120 decibels or people with hearing losses of 60 decibels. And some on the lower end might wear cochlear implants or might not wear anything at all. And those on the higher end might be wearing hearing aids or another device. To ensure it's a level playing field when we compete and no one's able to communicate audibly, we have to take hearing aids and cochlear implants off. And if you wear one whilst playing, then your team is disqualified. So it's one of those weird things that you perhaps might not expect. Like people think, you know, studs get checked and that doesn't really happen at a high level. But before games, it'll be managers coming down and slapping your ears to make sure you're not wearing anything on them, just because no one wants to take that risk. And it can be easy to forget to take them out. But in terms of communication on the field, a lot of it's sign language, which in a way is more efficient because I can communicate to somebody at the other end of the pitch, and only if somebody is watching me and knowing who I'm talking to can they understand the conversation. But if I'm screaming up the pitch like, "Oh, don't worry, I've got this corner," or "hold on to it, let's run the time down," or whatever you're trying to, you know, conversation you're going to get across, anyone will be able to hear that in a regular game of football and pick up on it.
Yeah, so you can get more subtle messages across to your teammates without others realizing, perhaps.
In a way, but in the other hand, where you'd be able to whisper in someone's ear before a free kick, you've got to sign to them, and anyone who can see you can see what you're signing. So there are ways you can be subtle, and there are ways that you can't.
There's always swings and roundabouts, isn't there? There's always a plus side and a downside.
Yeah.
Here's a brief outline of the successes we're talking about, the ones I alluded to before. Won the English Deaf Football League and the British Deaf Football Plate with Charlton in your first year. Moved to Fulham in 2013, won the English Deaf Cup, British Deaf Cup and British Deaf Plate in 3 years. Competed in the European Champions League 3 times. I think that was before you went off to the US after that. Part of the GP squad that reached the quarterfinals of the 2016 World Cup, represented GB at the Deaf Olympics in 2017, reaching the quarters. Moved to Doncaster after your time in the US, won the British Deaf Cup, reached the European Champions League finals. That's not really a bad record, is it? There's a lot to be proud of there.
Certainly. Certainly a lot to be proud of. And hugely grateful, blessed, fortunate, proud of the accomplishments. I think definitely for me, number one was always playing for my country. That was always the thing I've been most proud of. But certainly the trophies along the way, sit very nicely and very fond memories.
Yeah, because that was going to be my next question, was if there's any standout highlights, but those experiences at the Deaf Olympics and the World Cup must be very, very special for you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, if I had to say one moment, and it's a really difficult one, but one moment would be kind of walking out for my first international cap in Italy, that first game against Ukraine at the World Cup. Yeah, it was an amazing feeling. Amazing feeling, a dream finally coming true after 16 odd years of playing, training and growing up and all of the adversity overcome to get to that point. Yeah, certainly a day I look back on with very fond memories.
Was that always the aim to try and make it and represent your country? Or was it something that, I mean, you say 16 years of work, but I don't know if that ever was at the forefront of your mind right from the get-go?
Yeah, no, it was. I never thought it was going to be the deaf football team. But playing for my country was always the goal for me. And I tell this story when I speak sometimes, is we discussed earlier how football became that escape for me very early on in my life. And I used to play every break time and lunchtime at school. And I'd get back from school, I'd go out in the back garden, I'd keep playing until it got dark. And mum and dad would drag me in to have my dinner. I'd come and eat my dinner and I'd sit down in front of the telly and see if there was a football game that I could watch. Like, it's all I wanted to do, it was all I was thinking about. And I remember watching England play very, very vividly on the television and just sitting there in awe. Like, this game that I'm so passionate about and I love so much, here I am watching the 11 best players in the entire country compete against 11 of the best players from a different country in this sport. Like, it would be amazing one day if I could get to that level and have that experience and make the people back home proud and be a part of that squad representing them. So, yeah, for me, ever since about 4 or 5 years old, that's something I dreamed of achieving. But I don't think I'm unique in that sense. I think there are millions of boys and girls up and down the country that have a very similar dream of playing football or representing their country in whatever sport they're passionate about. But it's certainly one that stayed with me, and there were times in my life where it felt more possible than others. But yeah, certainly a big goal of mine ever since I was a very young lad.
Yeah, and realising the dream is sure to stick around in your memory for a long time. What were the toughest challenges through your career? Perhaps where you thought it wasn't going to happen?
Sure. So, I mean, there's lots of tough challenges. I think the biggest one is in 2015, before the European Championships. So I'd been called up to the training squad for the European Championship back in 2014. So 18 months prior to the tournament, there were about around 30 players called up to the training squad. And only 23 were going to be going to the final tournament. And over the course of the next 18 months, players were cut along the way. And we, it came down to the last training camp which was about 2 or 3 weeks, I think, before we were due to fly out for the tournament. And we had 24 players in the squad. And I was one of them. I've been playing really well. I felt quite confident about getting a place in the squad. But yeah, at the end of that training camp, we had conversations with our managers on a one-to-one basis, with the head coach as well, about kind of their plans for us at the tournament. And some players went in to have conversations about how, you know, you can be one of the key players in that squad, probably start every game, you know, have a real impact. Others were going to be players who were maybe going to come off the bench, try and change the game if things aren't going our way. Others were going to be in the squad but might not play, just there in case of injury cover. I thought one of us was going to have a conversation about how we're the last player cut from this squad. And it's a memory I have so, so vividly, just because of what a pivotal point it was in my career, that I was the sixth player called in to the manager's office. And I went in, sat down, the manager was over the desk from me on my right, head coach on my left. And we had a really positive discussion. I feel like the progress you've made, your work ethic, professionalism on and off the pitch, you know, I've been hugely, hugely impressed with your standard of play. But due to your inexperience on an international stage, you are going to be the last player that's cut from this squad. And I remember hearing that, and it broke me instantly. But I held it together just about in the manager's office with a bit of a trembly lip. I think they could tell I was upset. But I came out of that office, I walked straight out of the building, I sat down on the bench, and I just burst into tears. And I was inconsolable. I was so, so upset. And at that point, I drove home from that training camp, as we all did, about half an hour, 45 minutes later, after all the meetings had been had, and we said goodbye to each other. And I had a 3-hour drive home from that training camp, which is a really long time to be alone with your thoughts, but especially after getting news like that. And I remember having all sorts of thoughts running through my head about how I've let myself down, let family and friends down, people who have been so understanding of the sacrifices I've made in my life, but they also impacted them in terms of events that I've missed. And so I've gone back and told them that, well, this is something I was giving everything I had towards. I was giving it my very best, but my best still wasn't good enough. And I thought about giving up on football altogether. I thought, do you know what, that dream of playing for my country, maybe that's just not going to come true. Maybe Fulham and Champions League is all it's going to be for me, which is more than a lot of people can say they've done with their careers. But before I got home, I made a promise to myself, which was I wasn't going to let somebody else tell me that my dream wasn't possible for me. And yeah, I went away that next off season and worked harder than I ever had done before. Went on to have a tremendous year and overcome that challenge and go on to play for my country. But yeah, that's certainly the challenge that stands out for me and one that really resonates. And I'm yet to meet somebody successful in or out of sport who hasn't overcome some significant adversity in some way.
That, I mean, hearing you talk about it, it's clear it's still there. You still remember it really, really vividly. And that's one of the key points I think you raise, is that whether you want to call it something to do with Instagram culture or whatever, it's so easy to put out the positive news and all the positive stories and actually hide away the moments like that, the difficult times, the challenges that you've had to face that have sort of broken you, at least temporarily anyway. And I think it's always so important to hear people talk like you just have about those moments where, you know, it's not all smiley happy news. There's a lot of tough things that people have to overcome in order to achieve their dreams. In your case, putting yourself back together after that, is that easier said than done as well? Because it's all well and good telling yourself must work harder than you ever have done before, but actually putting that into practice is a different thing to just, I suppose, telling yourself that.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely harder. Harder to do than it is to say. And I think that's true for a lot of things. Like having a big picture and knowing what you want to do, I think is relatively easy. But having the discipline, having the motivation, to go and actually put in the work to make that reality and stay true to what you've said you're going to do for yourself is a very, very difficult task. And I think it's born from, it's born deep within yourself when you truly decide what you want to achieve and to push yourself to see what you're capable of. Like, it's okay to try and to fail, but there's real shame in just not trying at all because you fear of the failure and not wanting to have to suffer that. And I think for me, it was just such a strong desire to achieve something I'd wanted for so long. And although I'd been so close and had it ripped away from me, it probably was exactly what I needed at that point. Had I made that squad, I probably wouldn't have even played. I would have been in that squad as kind of part of injury cover. And would I have had that same hunger, that same desire to want to go on, pursue and progress? Or would that have just been enough for me to have been in the squad and maybe popped on for 5 minutes and earned the cap? I don't know. That wasn't something a journey I went down. But I think everything, looking back, it's very easy to connect the dots, right? Steve Jobs gave this great speech about at Stanford on the commencement addresses he gave before he passed. Now, looking back, it's very easy to connect the dots and see how when one thing happens, something else happens, and you need that happen for the next thing. But looking forward, that's very, very difficult. And when you get news like you've not made a squad or whatever, it feels like the end of the world at the time. But actually, it's often a little kick you need, a little nudge in pushing you to work even harder or to put yourself in a better position the next time. So certainly a real, real challenge to getting that work done. But actually, when I look back on my career and things I really miss, is I miss getting to the training ground before anyone else and getting extra work in the gym. And I miss staying later to get extra touches on the ball. And I miss doing that extra work just to ensure when the Saturday came, I was more prepared than anybody else. I was fitter than anyone else on that pitch. Now I was going to do a better job. And they're the parts I miss. Like, I miss the games, of course, the thrill, the adrenaline of playing, the trophies, they're all great. But you miss those small things about the work that goes in behind the scenes, those coach journeys with your teammates. And yeah, so although they're hard and although they suck, they're the most rewarding.
Did that knockback make you a better player? I'm wondering if that knockback didn't happen, would you have gone on to get into the squad eventually?
Who knows? I don't know. I think, yeah, ultimately it did make me better. And it made me better because that hunger is there and because I worked harder because of it. And that's not to say I was a slacker beforehand, and not by any stretch, but I became relentless. I became so focused on that. And everything I was doing was towards that one goal. So yeah, certainly, without a question, I think it helped me to become a better player. What I would have achieved without it, would I have found that fire and that drive from somewhere else? I don't know. Like I say, it's not a road I went down, but certainly helped me to improve.
Definitely. The flip side to this, and you kind of alluded to it there, was having to retire at 24 due to injury. And again, very big question. How do you manage having to stop when you don't want to stop? I suppose that's the position you were in at the time.
Yeah, it's a really tough question. And it's something I'm still managing with. Like, I don't have an answer for that. I'm 27 now, but I stopped playing in the summer of 2018. So it coming up to 3 years. And it's still something I'm coming to terms with, not being able to compete and not being able to do something I love at all, really. I was fortunate that it wasn't a snap injury. Like, it wasn't an immediate injury that when it occurred, I knew that was the end of my career. It was kind of one that had happened over a period of time. The cartilage had worn away in my knee, and suddenly it was becoming an issue that was a little niggling to something I was, you know, having to deal with on a significant basis. And it got to the end point in my last season where I wasn't training. I was only playing. But it was, I would limp around for 3 or 4 days after the game. It was a very difficult decision to make, but it was the right one just to ensure that I wasn't permanently permanently in pain or permanently walking with a limp or struggling to get up and down stairs and things like that. But to make that decision, very difficult, something I'm still trying to come to terms with. And I think that the hardest part is this was something I did almost every single day of my life in some capacity since I was about 4 years old. And suddenly 2 decades later, I'm never going to do that. And I think a lot of people, hopefully, were, you know, another 60 years left in me. Like, well, what am I going to fill that void with? And I'm yet to find something I'm as passionate about. And I'm fortunate I've got a job that has a really great impact. And I'm super excited to go and do that. I do some tremendous work with the Mintridge Foundation. And I'm an ambassador for a number of other charities as well. And they're all very fulfilling roles, and I'm able to give back and have an impact. But it's very different from having that passion that I had for football. And I think it's something I'm going to have to figure out, and I don't have a concrete answer for you on at the moment, unfortunately.
Yeah, now I think a lot of people, again, can relate to that. It's very similar to the conversation we had with Lizzie Simmons, you obviously know from Mintridge too, where she's wrapped up her self-worth in her performance in swimming. So when she retired, what's there to fill that void? And I suppose it does take a lot of time, doesn't it? Or essentially time to come to terms with it in some way. I imagine time as a healer is the old saying, isn't it? And I don't know if the 3 years that have passed have made it easier to come to terms with, but it's I get what you're saying, and it's still not the same as, you know, having that fire in your belly every time, you know, a game is coming up or, you know, training is coming up.
Yeah, I think it's certainly easier today than it was the day after I retired. I think it's been easier this year because nobody's been playing football. Like, it's been a real challenge, and deaf football hasn't been allowed to carry on where the Premier League has. And so I'm selfishly, in a way, I'm not seeing old teammates of mine that are either younger or older than I was going away and competing. And I found that to be, seeing them compete, like, always gets me really excited for them, because I remember that feeling, but almost also making me really sad for myself, because I want to be out there with them. So not having that reminder, and now I can see that has made things slightly easier. But now in my role as chairman of Fulham, a club that I used to play for, I really want the football to get back out there, because I can see the boys jump out of the bit and they want to play. And I remember that feeling, you're in an off season, you're desperate for the games to start up again. And I'm just hopeful we can safely move past the pandemic and get games up and running, and hopefully finish the season off if possible, because there's nothing quite like it. And I'm fortunate in a way that I haven't had half a season or a season stolen from me because of the pandemic. It was stolen a couple of years ago for another reason. But yes, I think time will heal with things, and getting back into football in a slightly different capacity will hopefully help that.
Yeah, and I think there's still probably correlations in that. It's whether it's a season or half a season that's been stolen thanks to a pandemic or a knee injury in your case, it's still not a controllable, you can't control it. And that's probably the toughest part for a lot of people, isn't it? It's just nothing you can do about it. And kind of going back to the Deaflympic side of things and it being its own separate entity from the Paralympics at the same time. And I suppose bearing in mind your role as chairman of Fulham, like you just mentioned there. And I imagine that, you know, growing the sport, keeping the sport healthy in terms of participation, coverage is one of your big passions as well. Maybe not quite on the playing side, but still something you care about deeply. Is that an issue in terms of coverage and trying to get the participation levels up and trying to get the sport in front of people as something that people can enjoy from a fan's perspective, or something that people can take part in when they are, you know, a deaf person such as yourself?
Yes and no. So participation levels are really, really high for deaf people in sport. There's not a shortage of elite athletes that are able to compete at a very, very high level. So I don't think Deaflympics so much is a participation issue. But the issue around coverage and subsequently funding that goes with it is a real, real issue for the Deaflympics. And whereas, and it's an IOC recognised sanctioned event, but it, because of the number of deaf athletes, the Paralympics is already an immensely long tournament and summer games because of the different categories of disabilities you have within each sport. So rather than just having 100 meter final men's and women's like you do at the Olympics, you have men's and women's, but for each different category of disability. And you've got that across almost all of the sports. To add deafness as another category to every single event and every sport would make that take even longer. But the history behind Deaflympics goes back a really long time. It's not something that started recently. But certainly the coverage is, it, I think, lacking in this country. Very few people hear about it. When I speak about it, weren't even aware that it exists. It's better in other countries. We had the Deaflympics that I went to in 2017 in Turkey. But it was a really big deal for them. It was on, you know, national television. It was on different channels. Every event was covered. They invested so heavily in their athletes and in the facilities to host the games. And as a result, they are one of the best countries when it comes to deaf elite sports. And you look at other countries that maybe don't have the funding, but are still able to compete at a high level. And it's just a really interesting dynamic to see. So absolutely, I think funding is a big issue and coverage is lacking there. But participation, I really don't think is an issue. There's a huge, huge number of people who get involved with sport and are able to train and compete at a really high level. The opportunity is there, but it's often a sacrifice for those elite athletes in terms of their livelihoods for the sport, because it's very difficult to find an income stream in elite deaf sport because the coverage just isn't there.
How do you change that? Is it just encouraging broadcasters, other forms of media, just to take a gamble essentially and put their all into covering it in a way they might cover another event?
Yeah, I don't have the answer. I don't know how you go about changing that situation. Some coverage is needed, like to fly your entire filming crew out and cover a, you know, 4-week games is obviously a huge investment. And now make decisions whether that's going to be viable or not. And it's going to, even when it occurs, because it occurs a year out of sync of the regular Olympic and Paralympic cycle. So we had our Olympics in 2017 or 2016. And so they were due to take place in 21 this year, whereas Tokyo was due to take place last year. But just as Tokyo has been pushed back, so the Deaf Olympics. So I think they've been pushed back now to May 22. Because of that, you're talking about when that event is ongoing, it's going to be competing with other sports like the Football European Championships or rugby tournaments or other athletic events that are taking place. And for a broadcaster, that becomes a balance of what's going to get more eyes on and what people more want to see. So I don't know the solution to changing the coverage, but certainly if you're able to do it from a written perspective, you're certainly able to get it recorded and up on YouTube and more accessible that way. So it's not necessarily such a heavy investment for people. It doesn't take up as much airtime, but it's still able to build some sort of following. So further down the line, that can come.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely something that people can look at in terms of, I mean, when you look at blogs and things like that, and maybe that's a way down. That route is you get some bloggers on board and create your own content. Make sure you follow Sportspiel on social media. Search for Sportspiel Pod on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or on LinkedIn. Rounding up into my final part, really, of this chat, and here's another big question to throw at you. What drives Phil Camps now?
It's a great question. And for me now, and you'll notice this about every kind of hat that I wear, not the Ravens one, but the different jobs that I do, is that every role I have now, in a way, whether that's directly or indirectly, has an impact on other people's lives. And I think for me, that's been a real focus coming out of football. Is I was so fortunate to have lived out a childhood dream at the age of 21 and to be done with it by the age of 24. That I'm hugely passionate about providing that opportunity and giving other people the motivation, the inspiration, the drive, the realization that it's possible for them to go and do the same. And whether that's playing football for their country or it's, you know, going on to be a scientist that comes up with an invention that changes the way we work within the world, or it's a violinist that goes on to play in orchestras all around the world. The element that they're passionate about isn't important to me, but what's important is people have the opportunity to pursue their dream. And everything I do now is focused around that. And my drive when I get up in the morning and when I finish my 9 to 5 to jump onto other calls and different meetings is to provide that opportunity for other people. I share my mantra all the time, and I'll do it here as well, is to dream big, to work hard, and to stay humble. Everyone has a dream of some sort. For some it's very small, for others it's very, very big. And I always encourage people to dream as big as they can with that. There's that saying which is, if you aim for the moon, even if you miss, you'll end up among the stars. And I think that's very, very true, but dream as big as you can with that goal or that area that you're passionate about. And if you're willing to put that hard work in, there's no reason you can't achieve it. But I think understanding that we've got 7 billion people, I don't know if it's 8 now, but we've got a lot of people on the planet. Every single one of us has a dream. The truth is, not everyone goes on to achieve that dream. And often the difference between the people who do and the people who don't is that hard work that they're willing to put in, that sacrifice they're willing to make. And the last part is staying humble. So after you've dreamed big, after you've worked hard, and after you've achieved that, it's to remember where you started. It's remember the teachers and coaches and parents who helped you along the way. And it's to give back in hopes of allowing others to do the same. You know, put your hand back down and try and pull people up with you. And I think that's the element, the part of the mantra that I'm on now, is about staying humble and about trying to pull other people up and help them to be successful in their own way.
And it's definitely a positive mantra to be sharing around, because I know you're doing lots of talks still on that front. And I kind of asked that because to me anyway, you're one of those people that just has that gift of, you just lift the room when you're in it. Probably going to embarrass you on a Saturday morning, but you know, you're the one who always like cracks a joke or says hello to a stranger and just instantly puts like the room at ease, which is a real gift to have. And like, is that something that just comes naturally to you?
Yeah, I mean, very kind of you to say. Very kind of you to say. I'm sure other people maybe don't find it as such a positive thing, maybe find it a little annoying when I do it. But yeah, no, certainly love a bit of humour. I try to think about the emotion that makes me feel best. Like, I mean, before, without getting too deep or philosophical, but like life in general, like I'm happiest. I enjoy it most when I'm loved and when I'm laughing, or when I'm loving and when I'm laughing. To go into a room and start loving people, bit tricky, but to go in a room and start making people laugh and having a bit of fun, it is much easier to do. And so yeah, always looking for a bit of humor where I can. But I just love meeting people. I love hearing other people's stories. It's always such a pleasure and an honor to tell mine, but I'm so passionate about, you know, hearing other people's stories. And I've loved listening to the Sports Girl podcast in hearing other athletes and kind of their journey, because there's always so much to learn. And it doesn't matter if it's someone who's gone on to be a double Olympic gold medalist, or somebody who's, you know, just out on a Sunday morning walking their dog. Everyone's got an interesting story to tell, and I love hearing those. So yeah, the more people I speak to, the more stories I get to hear, and the happier I am. So yeah, very kind of you to say. It's not something I consciously do. It's just something that I'm just naturally curious about, and a natural mode I fall into, I guess.
Yeah, and to me, the world needs people like that anyway, and those who want to hear other people's stories. Because like you say, ask a couple of questions and there'll be a whole another backstory that you never really realised just from looking at a person's career or success record on face value. And you mentioned right at the start all the different hats you're wearing at the moment too, whether it's Mintridge Foundation, of course, Kent County Council grad scheme, I think, is on the cards at the moment too, and the chair of Fulham, which you mentioned earlier. Juggling all of that, it's a lot. Does it ever feel like it's getting on top of you? Or, and you know, you've mentioned about liking keeping busy, but is juggling that, and I suppose giving time for yourself at the same time, something that can be a challenge?
Yeah, I think absolutely. Trying to find a balance between all the different hats and the 9 to 5 working at the Kent County Council in the transformation team is really enjoyable, and obviously takes up the large portion of my time. And then finding time to do the different roles outside of that, whether that be, you know, Mintridge Foundation, Kent Football League, Sports for Champions, or whether that's, you know, on the board at the Kentish Deaf Association or the chair at Fulham, it's finding time to balance life and living that, and also giving back in those roles that I do. Lockdown, strangely in a way, has found made things a little easier to find that balance, because the living life side of things has been a little harder to do, like to go out and do things with others. And so there has been more time to jump on meetings and stuff. But equally, meetings take a lot less time now, because I don't have to drive 3 hours to get to them. I can simply turn on my computer and jump into a call like this one. So yeah, it's a difficult balance to find. And some weeks it's much easier than others. But I think it comes back to what I mentioned earlier about having a real drive to what you do. When you're passionate about what you do and your work has an impact, it's much easier to pull yourself out of bed at 5 in the morning, knowing that everything I do today is going to increase kind of the opportunities and well-being and just general provision for other people is a real driver for me. And when I wake up and think, I'm sure you could stay in, but you know, there's some people to give back to here. Let's get ourselves up and get cracking. That makes things much easier.
And on that note, ties in very nicely with the Mintridge Foundation and the important work that they do, which we've obviously mentioned a lot of times on this podcast and on previous shows as well. And that goes hand in hand with your own mantra, doesn't it? Just all the work that you get to do with them. And you see firsthand how it affects children positively.
Yeah, like the Mintridge Foundation are fantastic, and I've been fortunate to be involved with them for over 5 years now. I think 2015 in January sort of time was when I joined. As you said, we spoke about a lot on this podcast before, but the work and the impact that the foundation has across the country is ginormous. But absolutely, it's about giving an opportunity for those kids, and was born out of Alex being in that position herself growing up. So yeah, tremendously honoured and very grateful to be involved with such a wonderful organisation.
Does having to do things remotely as well, whether it's talking to mentees and things like that, presented a new challenge when the pandemic first arrived?
Yeah, so mentees has always been done remotely. Like, we'd initially meet in person at school, but the subsequent mentoring program was done remotely anyway. Certainly virtual events is a different thing, because I think so much about going in and speaking and playing sports with children and coaching them is that interaction you get on a personal level. For them, there's a lot of, you know, or in seeing you in person right there in their school, coaching them play football with their footballs. And you remove from that element a little bit in being online, but you're still able to build that personal connection. You're speaking to a school live directly. It's not a pre-recorded message in most circumstances. You get to answer questions. So it's been a challenge. It's been an adaptation. I'm sure Alex and Katie and co at Mintridge would be able to tell you that. But I think it's one that the foundation has done tremendously well, and we're still able to have a really positive impact in the wider community, despite of not being able to go into schools.
Yeah, and another real testament to collective effort and drive. Like you said, if you're passionate about something, things will happen. And that's evidently been the case these last few months. Final question for you, And if you can fast forward maybe to 5 years from now, where do you see yourself?
5 years from now?
Hopefully we'll be out of the pandemic by then.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Fingers crossed we won't still be in lockdown. I think, yeah, not sure how we'd all find that. But no, 5 years from now is a great question. I don't know. I don't have a particular goal on the radar at this point, which is really strange because, you know, so much of my life there was a goal, there was a target, something to work in towards. I think for myself, in 5 years, I want to be in a similar place where I am now, which is having an impact on other people's lives in a positive way, but enjoying myself and enjoying the time that I have, you know, hopefully another 60 years, not being too morbid, but just enjoying life and trying to make the most of it. Spending more time with family, my girlfriend, friends, is something I'm really, really looking forward to, as I'm sure a lot of us are coming out of the pandemic. But yeah, I think just making more of an impact, continuing with that good work, and spending more time with loved ones.
Definitely. I think you've always been naturally inclined to think that way anyway, but even personally, I think a lot of people going through what they're going through now are probably rethinking a lot of things and wanting to do something similar. So I do hope that is one positive that comes out of all of this.
One thing just to mention in terms of 5 years' time will be, hopefully by that point, we'll have number 8 in the Mintridge quiz champions bag.
Of course. Do you keep those little trophies anywhere?
I don't get a trophy. I think anyone gets a trophy if they beat me, but I don't think anything come through.
Of course. You still won't have won the Christmas competition, Christmas jumper competition by that point, though.
Well, the thing is, I'm a bit stubborn, Alistair, so I'm refusing to buy a different Christmas jumper. So I'm going to keep wearing this one until they say it's good enough to win. How long that will take, I don't know.
I hope you've got a good few years to wait. Patience is a virtue.
Yeah, seem to be second or third every year.
And with that, I bring this particular episode to an end. But thank you, Phil, for coming on, because personally, I really enjoyed it. But I think it's one of those chats that will make you feel positive about things ultimately once you've finished listening to it. But it's also one of those where I think it's got some really, really important messages there about dreaming big, but also not letting those setbacks and those challenges take you over, and how those can make you a better person or better player, better whatever, depending on what that difficulty is. So thank you for being very open about all of that and sharing your own experiences. And ultimately, best of luck in whatever goal, dream you might have in the near future.
Yeah, brilliant. Thanks, Alistair. It's been a real pleasure. It's been nice to come on and speak.
As ever, a huge, huge thank you to Phil for taking part in this podcast episode, and of course a big thank you to our partners, the Mintridge Foundation. You can find links to Phil's website and also the Mintridge website in the show notes of this podcast. One quick message to fire out there to everyone: on Wednesday, February the 17th, I will be hosting a virtual workshop with the School of Journalism and News Associates, where I did my journalism training, all about how to start a podcast. It's free. You don't have to be a journalist, but if you are thinking about doing your own pod, do feel free to come along. Or if you just want to ask me some nice questions, that's also allowed as well. The link to that event is also included in the show notes of this episode. As ever, if you enjoy our show, please spread the word on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and on Instagram. All of our handles are at SportSpielPod. And if you ever want to get in touch with us, you can email us at sportspielpod@gmail.com. That is it for this particular episode of Sportspiel. Take care, everyone, in this crazy, crazy world, and we will see you very soon.